The Tom Woods Show, episode 507.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If you're thinking of starting that new blog or website, now's a great time because I have increased the bonuses I'm giving away. I've got a free ebook on how to start that blog or website. I've got a free video tutorial showing you how to get up and running in 5 minutes. I'm giving away 24 free video tutorials to make you an expert WordPress blogger, and I'm giving you free publicity for that blog or website. How? Well, before you start that blog, check out tomwoods.com/publicity. Welcome to episode 507. What an interesting topic we have today, and it's totally unexpected. Here's what I mean by that. I was recently on Live Free FM at livefreefm.com. It's the podcast of Nathan Frazier, and he asked me a series of questions that I've never been asked before. When I go on a podcast, a lot of times people say, how did you become a libertarian, and this and that. Questions sort of like that. What's Austrian economics? And I'm perfectly happy to answer questions like that. They're quite natural. But Nathan had me on and asked me totally different questions. And in particular, he wanted to know, why should anarcho-capitalism be preferred over anarcho-socialism? In other words, in the primordial question of how society is going to be arranged, do we give priority to property or not? Do we acknowledge a right of private property? And if so, how do we parry the claim that private property introduces rivalry into society? It introduces conflict into society because I'm constantly saying, this is mine and it's not yours and so on and so forth. Isn't this a problem? So he raised questions like this with me again and again, and I didn't expect any of these questions, so I'm answering them spontaneously and on the fly, and you can judge for yourselves whether I did a good job or not. But either way, I thought you might enjoy listening to it, and if you do enjoy it, you might also consider listening to Nathan's podcast. Livefreefm.com is where you can find it. I will, of course, be linking to it on today's show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/507. I have a big, big reminder for you after my conversation with Nathan here, so please do stay tuned. Don't switch it off as soon as I'm done talking with him. It's sort of a favor to ask, but I'm asking you a favor in the sense that I want you to help me help you. So please do join me as I help you help yourself. I don't know what it is I'm trying to say, but I'm trying to do something that I think is going to benefit you. So please be benefited. Allow yourself to be benefited. You'll see what I mean after I'm done. I should just stop talking. Let's get talking about socialism and capitalism. Here's my chat with Nathan Frazier, and I hope you enjoy it.
Tom Woods from tomwoods.com. Tom, how you doing today?
Doing well, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
I have to say thank you for joining me today. I am incredibly honored, and when I reached out to you and you responded, I was just completely dumbfounded. I couldn't even believe that you got back a hold of me, so thank you for coming on. Now, you do the Tom Woods Show, and I would like to allow you at the beginning of the show to kind of let people know who aren't aware of what your work is. What is it that you do that makes you so busy that you rarely have the chance to come on a show like mine?
Well, I did recently just finish a huge project that has given me a little bit of extra time, thank goodness. I spent about 2 years, actually, creating courses for Ron Paul's homeschool curriculum, which you can visit at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And I created about 400 videos on history from antiquity up to the present and on government. But my government course is the exact opposite of every other government course you've ever heard of, because my government course is an anti-government course. It's a whole series of lessons on things the government shouldn't be doing, and here's why, and here's what Rothbard said. I mean, the kids are not going to know what hit them when they take these courses. So that took a lot of my time. But I do keep busy because for some reason, once I finish one thing, I tend to jump into something else. I've written a bunch of books. I've had some success with those. But now I have this daily podcast. I've also been doing that for about 2 years. I release a new episode every single weekday at tomwoods.com. I've had everybody from Ralph Nader to Ron Paul on the show. I've had Kane, the WWE wrestler. I've had just a wonderful variety of guests. And a lot of times people say, I love the episodes with guests I've never heard of because it makes me walk away saying the Liberty bench is a lot deeper than I thought it was. It's all these people I'd never heard of. It's not just Ron Paul, Peter Schiff, Judge Napolitano. There are a whole bunch of other people out there. And I try to cover just every topic under the sun that might be of interest to libertarians or might be something that your friends are arguing with you on, you don't know how to answer. My tagline at the end of the show is become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day.
Yeah, and I have to credit you with this. Before I really started delving into economics and political structure, I've always been kind of an anarchist-minded individual. I was very liberal in my upbringing, so I was kind of like a government should not exist, but if it does, at least it should take care of the poor. And I started listening to your show, and between your show and reading Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, you two pretty much completely did a 180 on my understanding of economics and history and everything. And so I just wanted to thank you for that, because a lot of times people say you're just barking into the wind when you're trying to get these ideas out. But for me personally, the work that you have done and your recommendation to read that book was actually what made me do a turnaround on my understanding of economics. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk with you about today. I wanted to propose an imaginary scenario. We're constantly inundated in the liberty movement and in the conspiracy theory, quote-unquote, realm of this October or this September, the economy is going to collapse and the government's going to fall apart and all this fear-mongering. I kind of wanted to just kind of pretend that that actually did happen. And in the wake of that, we had a debate about property rights, because that seems to be the biggest qualm or the biggest difference between the anarcho-socialists and the anarcho-capitalists and the free market libertarians versus the left libertarians is this idea of property rights. Where do you fall on the idea of property rights? Are they a legitimate right, or are they a way for hierarchy to oppress people?
All right. Well, even within the private property rights, the people who favor private property rights realm, there's even a debate among those people as to whether the right to private property is a natural right that you have just by virtue of being human, or it's a conventional right that the community grants to you because it seems to work better on utilitarian grounds, but you don't strictly have a natural right to your property. Well, I do come down on the property rights side, and I do come down on the natural rights side of the property rights side, but I can also make a utilitarian consequentialist sort of argument. I can say that things do in fact work better if we have private property, and I realize that runs contrary to what people would think, because I think most people don't really sit down and reflect on things like this. So I think people would be inclined to go along with what Rousseau said, that you know, private property in a way is a kind of theft, for that the first person who stood on a plot of ground and said, "This is mine," is the person who introduced conflict into the world. I think there are people who feel like that's probably right, but you know, what are we going to do? This is the society we have. But to the contrary, I would say it's the person who says nobody can own anything who introduces conflict into the world. And the reason for that is every one of us has goals that we want to reach. And typically, our imagination is limitless in terms of all the goals we could conceivably want to reach. And there aren't enough resources in the world for all of us simultaneously to carry out and try to pursue all the goals we could possibly pursue. There just isn't enough of everything. So we have to figure out some way that we can get along with each other in society without, if I may use this word, trespassing on the rights of other people and the pursuits that other people may want to follow. And how can we do that, given that there's a limited amount of stuff and there are more people who want to use that stuff than there is stuff? And the answer is we need some system that would clearly indicate that this property belongs to one person as opposed to another. And what that means is that this property can be used by this person. If we go around saying nobody has any property, well, if we understand property means something you can use according to your own discretion, then to say nobody has property means nobody can use anything, unless presumably they get the consent of everybody else. Maybe we say that we actually own everything in common. Well, all right, if I'm growing an apple tree then, do I have to get the consent of everybody else in society to eat that apple? Well, obviously we'd all be dead if we had to do that. So to say that nobody owns anything, that can't possibly be right, because that would mean that or that we all own it together, that would mean I'd have to get the consent of every other person. That's not possible. So if your theory means the human race perishes, it can't be right. So there's that. But then secondly, suppose you and I both want to use we both want this particular watermelon, and we both want the entire watermelon. Now, you could say, well, you could share the watermelon. All right, well, let's imagine that there are things that that you couldn't share. Let's say we both want to use a particular car at the same time, and I want to drive to A and you want to drive to B. Those are mutually exclusive goals. Well, how does it help to say, well, nobody really owns that car, or we both own the car? How does that help? How does that help decide who uses it right now? Well, it doesn't. And so you and I would have to come to blows over that. There would be no way to resolve that. So, I mean, you could say, well, okay, I'll let you use it, but then I'm giving up what I wanted to do with it. And so then, so in other words, what property rights do is they make clear in a way that everyone can understand, they draw a connection between an individual human being and an individual good or plot of land or whatever, so that we minimize conflict. Everybody understands this is the sphere in which I am allowed to act on this particular land, and you can't tell me what to do. And here is the sphere in which you are allowed to act, and I can't tell you what to do. And this way, instead of constantly screaming and arguing with each other, well, I want to grow corn in this land. Well, I want to build a building on this land. There is no resolution for that. But there is a resolution if I say, if we establish that I have satisfied the conditions that make this plot mine, and you have satisfied the conditions that make that plot yours, and so you can live your life peacefully, I can live my life peacefully, and we don't have to vainly scream at each other over what's to be done with any particular good or any particular plot of land. Everybody knows, everybody can establish for themselves, this person is the owner because he has satisfied these requirements that we can all perceive. And so private property rights come about through various ways, but we can tell ways that they couldn't possibly come about. We couldn't have a system of establishing property based on verbal declaration, that if I simply say, okay, that's mine, well, that doesn't – we want property because it helps us resolve conflicts, potential conflicts over scarce resources. But if I can claim something as my own simply by declaring it to be my own, you could just as easily declare it to be yours. And a third person could declare it to be his, and a fourth person. So we haven't resolved conflict at all. We've only magnified it. We need some system that if I abide by it, everybody can see that I have done that. And so what Hans Hoppe recommends, following sort of in the path of John Locke, Hans Hermann Hoppe, following in the tradition of John Locke but expanding on him, simply says that we have a first user, first homesteader principle. The first person to use something that's never been used before, or to homestead land that's never been homesteaded before, we recognize that person as the owner. And the reason is that if we were to say, and by the way, we see this just, you know, I had it first. We all know that instinctively as children. But the reason is if we were to say, well, how about the fifth user gets to be the one who decides what's done with it? Well, that would mean the first four users can't do anything. They can't even act with the thing. They can't grow food. They can't do anything until the fifth person comes along. There's no obvious alternative to this because, as I say, we have many goals we all want to reach. We have a limited amount of goods, so we can't reach all our goals. So we have to figure out some way to prevent conflict, given that there is conflict implicitly here, in that I have so many things in mind with what I want to do with all these things, but you have a lot of things in mind that you want to do with those things. We have to parcel this out somehow, and private property rights allows us to do that, to get along with each other, despite the fact that we all have goals that can't all be reached because there isn't enough stuff to go around. Only property gives us a peaceful resolution of this problem.
Now, I'm going to do something that I hear you do quite often on your show, and I'm going to play
devil's advocate.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, coming from my old point of view, and this is really easy for me to slip back into. What if I took the position that you owning this property is violating my right to travel? I want to get to point A, but in order to get there, I have to cross your property, or in order to get there as quickly and efficiently as possible, I have to cross your property. How is your owning property not a violation of my right to travel?
Okay, well, I guess I would have to get into your right to travel. Now, it sounds good. I mean, everybody feels like he has a right to travel, but simply asserting a right is not the same thing as demonstrating its existence. You do have a right to travel in places where you've been invited, but surely even you wouldn't say that my right to travel includes my right to travel into your bedroom, travel into your bathroom, to be taking a shower in your tub. So certainly you realize there at some level is a limit to the right to travel. Now, if you had a long-standing right to, you know, let's say there was some previously unowned property and everybody used to just walk through it, well, oftentimes this establishes an easement right to use this property. So even if somebody builds a house next to it, then we recognize this long-standing right to pass through this part of the property. So there are ways to incorporate what you're asking for. But really, you yourself realize that I can't travel anywhere I want. I mean, really, I could be following you around all day, all around your house, and I would just be saying I'm asserting my right to travel. You'd say, hold on a minute. There's a limit to your right to travel. And I'd say, okay, what is the limit? And what it would really come back down to would be property. It's that you don't have a right to travel on my property because this is my sphere of action. You know, given that, I mean, suppose I had elephants and you've got your property and I just say, I want to stampede my elephants through this area. And if you were to stop me, that would be violating my and the elephant's right to travel. At some point, you would say, I don't want elephants crossing through in front of my house all the time. I don't want strangers coming through or getting drunk on my property or throwing bottles everywhere. I don't want that. But on what grounds can you assert that you don't want that if your view is that no one can make decisions on any particular property because there's no such thing as property? It leads to all kinds of undesirable situations, and it leads to conflict where otherwise we would at least have some kind of understanding that here's where I can go, there's where you can go, and now we don't have to fight with each other over it. And now you don't have to disturb my peace. Because if you just trample through my property, you may say you're asserting your right to travel. But you're also disturbing my right to privacy. And if we're just going to talk about these abstract rights disembodied without being rooted in property, we're not going to be able to resolve this. Because you would admit I do have a right to property to privacy, and you have a right to travel. How can we resolve those two rights other than by coming to blows? The only way to do it is through establishing property rights. And then we realize that I have privacy on my land and my property, and you have the right to travel on your property and on the property of anybody who will freely admit you. And then we have no struggles with each other anymore.
Okay, so I'm gonna start throwing some curveballs at you.
So that one wasn't one. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was a good explanation, but these are where it really starts to get tricky. So say me and you are neighbors, and you have to wake up early tomorrow to get to work on time, and I have the need on my property to entertain guests and play music loudly until 2 o'clock in the morning. Where does your – how do we resolve, absent government, absent you calling the cops on me and me and you getting into a big conflict about this is my property. Well, this is my property. How do we resolve issues like that where I'm doing something on my property, but it is interfering with your ability to enjoy your property?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. Well, without having to get into the weeds of anarcho-capitalist theory, I'll just say as an assumption – that in the absence of government, we would still have some institution that we would delegate, well, that I would hire for the purposes of security, for example, because we believe in the division of labor. There's no reason that in the same way I don't do my own plumbing, I don't do my own making my own clothes, I also wouldn't do my own protection services. I'd have a gun maybe in a security system. But apart from that, I'm not going to monitor my property all the time. I have other things to do. So I would have an institution, and you would have an institution that you would go to if you were robbed or whatever, because we can't be vigilantes. I'm not good at it. I don't know where to look for the guy who stole my stuff. So I would hire somebody who specialized in it. So first of all, I'd have an institution that would help me in a case like this. So let's bear in mind there would still be some institution that would help resolve situations like this. But the question would be, how would it be resolved according to the principles of private property? How would that institution come to the right conclusion? And I see two possible ways out of this. One would be, I think people are much more likely in a stateless society to arrange themselves in what today we recognize as homeowners associations, that I'll join a neighborhood, but basically everybody understands that one of the rules, you know, one of the rules of this neighborhood that we all agree to when you pay your fee, and if you don't agree to it, then don't move into this neighborhood, is that after a certain time of night, the music has to stop. Now, it may be that I want to go to bed at 9 and the homeowners association says the music can go on till 11. Well, then I either have to change their minds on that or I got to find a different house. So it may even be that, you know, even with some rule in place, it still runs the music too late for me, but that's the rule. Well, likewise, on your end, the rule would be, look, you agreed to this. You consented to these rules when you moved here. And so if you're in violation of these rules, you're going to have to ask you to leave. So private property helps to resolve it. But suppose we're not in a situation like that. Suppose we're just two isolated households. We don't belong to any association. How would we resolve it then? Well, this is very similar to the question that Murray Rothbard examines in his book, The Ethics of Liberty. He takes the example of an airport making a lot of noise. Obviously, you got airplanes taking off all the time. And that's not even a question of they're doing it late or early in the morning, which maybe they are. It's they're doing it all day long, and it's really annoying. So how would we resolve that? We've got all these houses near the airport, and the airport is creating this unconscionable level of noise. And his answer is it depends, again, on who was there first. Because there is no non-arbitrary way to resolve this. There's no way to say, well, this is a reasonable level of noise. There's no non-arbitrary way to resolve that. So instead, you deal with the idea of the easement. You say that if there's an airport here first, and it's been emitting a certain level of noise over the years, and then suddenly I can't just build my house next to the airport and immediately start complaining about the noise. Like, well, the airport has been there for years emitting this noise. I knew that when I moved in. So we would say that the airport has homesteaded an easement right of noise emission. But suppose that the houses were there first, and then the airport comes along. Well, the houses have grown accustomed to a certain level of quiet. So the airport would have to come to some kind of accommodation with them. Maybe they pay them. Maybe they say, this is the level of noise we're going to be emitting, and if you guys are okay with that, we'll pay you some amount to make you whole, given that you're going to be suffering an inconvenience. So in other words, there are ways through easement rights that these sorts of issues could be resolved. If you have not, as my neighbor, homesteaded an easement right to emit noise at all hours of the night, then I would be in the right. But so in other words, there are ways of dealing with who's been doing what the longest. And then, of course, there's also a question of, you know, presumably two neighbors can try to figure out some way to work things out with each other. Like I could say, all right, look, I'll just put up some white noise machines in my bedroom. But in exchange for that, maybe you could mow my lawn. I mean, we should also bear in mind that human beings are not always going to be looking for conflict. A lot of times they will be looking for reconciliation, and they're going to look for ways to resolve their differences, and there is a multitude of ways that we can do that.
Okay, so I've got, I have so many questions for you.
Where the heck did the time, my answers are too long-winded, I think.
No, they're great because they really get to the heart of these matters. Do you mind if I ask you one more question, and then we can plug some of the stuff that I'm really excited that you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, one more question, and this is probably the biggest conflict that I see arise. The argument between absentee ownership and abandonment. When somebody, let's just pretend or assume that we both agree that you're the first person to use this property, so you have the right, and then you aren't using it, say like a summer home in Bali or something like that. while you're not using it, what differentiates an abandonment from an absentee ownership? And why is one legitimate and one, at what point, how long do you have to not be using something before I can step in and start using it?
All right. Well, let's say, I mean, obviously, if I were to drop dead, then, you know, that I'm really going to go a very long time not using it. So there would be some kind of common law. Because, I mean, with something like that, there is, again, there's no non-arbitrary answer. It's sort of like, you know, at what age do we let people start driving? Well, we know it's not going to be age 9, but we know it's not going to be age 35. So we have to, at some point, just pick a random number. So at some point, there is a random number involved here. I don't know what the number would be, but it would be something we would figure out together. But there's here'd be my comparison. Suppose I buy a suit, just a regular men's suit, and I hang it in my closet, and I wear it only once a year. If I wear it only once a year, does that mean that people can just come into my house and just use the suit as long as they dry clean it, bring it back, and hang it up? Can they use the suit if I'm only using it once a year? It's the same principle as an abandoned house, an abandoned suit. Or maybe I only use my computer once a week. Does that mean that other people can use my computer the other 6 days? Now, maybe there are some people who would go to that extreme. But then would they really want that principle turned around on them? They're not always in the shower. Couldn't I come use their shower? Now, they would say, oh, but, you know, look, I'm in the shower at least once a day. But it seems like the amount of time is, to some degree, somewhat arbitrary. I mean, everybody goes on vacation for a few days. Does that mean that if I go on vacation for 3 days, my property is secure? But if I go on vacation for the summer, I could come back and people are squatting there? Well, why? What's the difference? So in the same way, the people who are squatting, there are always going to be things that they themselves aren't using. I mean, you know, heck, when they're sleeping, maybe they're not even using their physical body. Think of all the bizarre things we could do there. I mean, so in other words, I don't think these people would really consistently apply this principle in their own lives, because we all, again, I don't use my car 24 hours a day. Does that mean I have to be content to have people driving it around, or I have to leave a schedule out, people sign up for times to use it? This would be highly impractical. And secondly, I actually gain a psychic satisfaction from knowing that something is there even when I'm not using it. I might not be using my security system all the time, but I'm glad to know that it's there. I'm not using my car all the time, but I'm glad to know that it's there. I'm not using the however much money is in my savings account. I mean, that by definition, I'm saving it. I'm not using it all the time. But, well, this is a bad example because the banks do take that money and go use it while I'm not using it. Bad example. But surely the average person can't just come into my bank account and say, well, look, you're not going to miss it. You're not using it right now. It's some of the value I get from things comes from not using it, from just the security of knowing that it's available to me. And you are violating that interior disposition of satisfaction and content and comfort that I gain from the property, even when I'm not just, you know, using it in an obvious and more crude sense.
Awesome. You just hit every single ball that I threw at you out of the park today. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Where can people go to find more of your work? And I wanted to give you the chance to plug your new project that you're working with Bob Murphy on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I have two podcasts. I have a million things I'm doing, but they all pivot around one thing, which is my weekday podcast. I'm at about 500 episodes, tomwoods.com. If there's some topic you want to know about that I haven't covered, let me know and we'll get to it. So that's the first thing, tomwoods.com. But secondly, I'm going to have to revamp tomwoods.com to include a link to this second project that Nathan just mentioned. Bob Murphy and I have a podcast now every single week. Every single week, we refute Paul Krugman's New York Times column. And so what we're trying to do is teach economics by refuting Krugman. So the show is called Contra Krugman, and it's up there at contrakrugman.com. And we are going to have a lot of fun with this. We're just, you know, we're just sort of getting our feet wet with it, but we're going to be in our groove soon, and I think this could be really big. So join us at tomwoods.com and contrakrugman.com.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. Everybody go to tomwoods.com and contrakrugman.com. Awesome stuff for you there. Like Tom said, close to 500 episodes. you're going to be busy for a while, and you're probably going to learn a lot. I know that I did. Tom, thank you for joining us.
All right, check out Nathan over at livefreefm.com. Not always suitable for work, but always thought-provoking, and it was my pleasure to be on his show. Let me remind you something before I talk about what's coming up tomorrow. Actually, I have no idea what's coming up tomorrow. I haven't thought about it yet. Tomorrow is a big dead zone in the scheduling of the show, so I'll probably do an episode on whatever on my own. So, yeah, I don't know what tomorrow is. No idea. So that's an empty false promise I'm making. But what I do want to remind you of is please, please, please attend my webinar. First webinar I'm ever doing. I'm just the co-host, but it's my first webinar ever, and it's this coming Tuesday, October 13th, 2015, and it's on how to build your email list. If you're a blogger or an entrepreneur or a business owner or whatever, you need an email list. You absolutely have to succeed. And you need to know how to start it, how to build it. And it's not easy to do to persuade somebody to give you an email address. They don't want to hand over their email addresses to anybody. So how are you going to get them to do it? Very important. I have a lot of experience in this, and I'm going to be sharing my insights and what's worked for me in this free webinar. And you can put these strategies to work right away, and you don't have to buy anything to be able to use these strategies. So just head over to that free webinar. And you can check it out at tomwoods.com/email webinar, all one word, tomwoods.com/email webinar. And if you're driving around and you don't remember that, it's also going to be linked at the show notes page, tomwoods.com/507. You have to reserve a spot. It's Tuesday, October 15th at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. I may have said 2 o'clock the other day because I'm thinking about my own time zone. 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Tuesday the 13th, you're going to learn a lot. It's a free webinar. You'd be crazy not to be there. So please, please, please register for this free webinar because it's going to help you. And if it doesn't help you, then I failed. And I try my best not to fail at things. All right, that's it. As always, thank you, thank you, thank you for listening. And I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.